Here at America's Exit Poll, there are 17 more shopping days until the election.
My name's Bob. I'm in Oklahoma, and I've been a Democrat all my life, but there's no way I'm going to vote for a man that I truly don't trust and truly don't know a lot about him.
Bob, there's still time to learn about the candidates running for president, but all over America, people are voting. We're polling early voters in states from coast to coast. How did you make up your mind? Tell us, or you're toast. Good morning. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It is Friday, October 17th. And John, so let me get this straight. You're going to go across the country toasting people?
No. It's like, tell us your story or your toast here at The Takeaway. We're not messing around.
I just wanted to make sure I got that straight. Listen, this hour we're going to take a closer look at the big drop in oil prices, why it happened and what it means for us, plus what it really means to be sleep deprived. Very relevant for morning show listeners and hosts like us. Those stories are coming up, but first, some headlines.
Wake up and realize European markets are gaining so far this morning. No such luck in Asia, where most markets closed down. Japan's Nikkei index managed to climb, though. It closed up 2.8% after a week of huge historic losses. Futures markets point to a lower opening for Wall Street. Traders will be watching housing starts data due out later this morning. That's the number of new homes contractors begin building, and they don't usually start a home until they think it can sell, so the number gives us a read on the real estate market.
President Bush will step out later this morning to try to talk up the markets. He's going to give a speech with more details on what the government is doing to stop the economic bleeding. The White House says not to expect any new proposals today. That speech is in a little later this hour, actually. President Bush is in a full court press to round up support for a deal with Iraq on American troops there. Top Bush administration officials are fanning out to gain support from U.S. and Iraqi leaders. A draft agreement includes a timeline for U.S. withdrawal by 2012. The Bush administration wants to get a deal done before the current agreement expires at the end of this year. We'll hear from Baghdad a little later on this story.
Elsewhere in politics, John McCain campaigns in Florida today. Barack Obama is in Virginia. The candidates are getting back to business after a night of laughs. McCain and Obama made fun of themselves and each other at the annual Al Smith charity dinner last night. It was actually pretty entertaining. McCain was also on Letterman while Joe Biden visited Jay Leno. Sarah Palin's turn is this weekend when she cameos on Saturday Night Live. I happen to be in Boston at WGBH, our partners, where Red Sox fans are glowing this morning following a crucial win last night. The Red Sox pulled out a comeback win over the Tampa Bay Rays from 7 runs down. It's amazing.
Go Red Sox. Now, the American League series moves to Florida. The Rays lead the series 3-2. The winner plays the Philadelphia Phillies in the World Series.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average had a little bit of a recovery yesterday. It begins trading at 89.79. The S&P begins at 9.46. Still a steep drop in oil prices. They're hovering around $71 a barrel. The polls are already open at the America's Exit Poll. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us how you made up your mind. We're America's Exit Poll.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Here and around the world, everyone is watching economic indicators very closely. And this week, many analysts found two of them particularly disturbing here in the U.S. The biggest monthly decline in industrial production numbers in 24 years and retail sales that dropped nearly 3%. With us to discuss what they mean is Bob Bruska, chief economist with Fact and Opinion Economics. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Bob, why are these numbers so important?
Well, the numbers are important because they're some of the key barometers of activity in our economy. The consumer is about 70% of GDP, gross national product. And if retail sales are getting weak, then that's a pretty bad sign. The retail sales report is released. It's just about half of consumer spending.
And so you argue that these numbers, among others, show that we are in a recession and have been since 2007. You want to explain?
Well, the decline in retail sales is significant. It's an ongoing decline now. Industrial production is off sharply. There was some hurricane and work stoppage effect in it, but still without those things, the decline in industrial production was severe. If you look back historically, you know, we've been losing jobs since January, and while it hasn't been severe, if you look at the period, it looks more like other recessionary periods, and it looks like something else. In fact, if you assume that the recession started in December, which a lot of economists have argued, you can stack it up against other recession periods, and it actually fits okay. There are actually two other recession periods where this deeply into a recession, they had lost fewer jobs than we have in this one, in percentage terms, not just outright terms, in percentage terms. So, you know, this really does fit in to the family of recessions, but with the declines we're seeing now, it's fitting more into the family of severe recessions.
I've heard some argue that there are 23 states that are currently in the midst of a recession. Would you agree with that, and would you describe what you think that means?
Well, I don't like that sort of designation. Recession is a macroeconomic term. That is, it's a term that applies to the entire economy. And so, according to my understanding of it, you can't have one state in recession. You can't have one industry in recession. You can have states that are doing so badly. They're doing as badly as though we were in a recession. You know, they may be doing worse than they do in some recessions. But a recession is a statement about the entire economy. It's not about a sector. It's not about a geographic area. It's about the economy.
You talked about the job losses. I think the numbers most commonly seen is somewhere around 750,000 jobs lost in the United States this year. The unemployment rate is somewhere around 6.1%. What do you think, what would you expect that we're going to be seeing in the next 3 to 6 months, let's say, on that front?
Well, the unemployment rate probably goes up to around the last peak that we saw. That would put it up around 7.8%, maybe 8%. Some people think it's going to go even higher. The economy gets worse. We have more job losses in addition to a hike in the rate of unemployment. Output declines further. You have a situation where the declines feed on one another and people get even more worried about whether we're able to stop it. That's typically part of a recession. This is part of the recession psychology. It isn't just a decline in output. Because you have GDP decline in sporadic quarters, a recession is when you put a period together where something bad happens in the economy and you have a totally different psychology operating.
Could you quickly describe to us your thought on the stimulus plan that was set up to inject some good news into the economy?
Well, what it did was it poked up a quarter of positive GDP, which helped to cause this quarter, the third quarter, to be an even weaker quarter. So it didn't really have any lasting impact. It didn't really avert the slide the economy was involved in. It did put about another $150 billion of debt on our books, and it really didn't, in some sense, do its job. Yeah, it did pump up spending for a while, but temporary tax cuts, one-time tax cuts, don't really have that lasting effect on people's spending. You want to have a lasting effect on people's spending, then you have to give them money in a lasting way, and typically you do that through a permanent tax cut.
Bob Bruska, thank you. Chief Economist of Fact and Opinion Economics here in New York. John?
Well, it's pretty interesting that persistence of a recession is a psychological matter. Well, if you're going to try to apply psychology to the oil markets, maybe schizophrenia is the word you would use. Remember the predictions that we'd soon see $200 a barrel oil? Those were the old days. Crude prices fell below $70 a barrel yesterday for the first time in 14 months. That's a 50% decline in value from just 3 months ago. OPEC members decided yesterday to hold an emergency meeting next week in Vienna to figure out how to defend their price from this what looks like a crash. To figure out what all this means for the economy, we're talking to New York Times reporter Jad Mouad. Jad, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
And, you know, this is an unprecedented sell-off over a three-month period. 50% decline is pretty amazing. What can OPEC do to stop this decline?
Well, I mean, you know, the OPEC producers are really starting to get, you know, awfully anxious. Just last week, they had scheduled an emergency meeting for next month. And yesterday, when we saw the prices fall under $70, they said, hang on a minute, we need to meet immediately. And they rescheduled, if you will, this emergency meeting for next week. You know, their tools are fairly limited, if you will. The only thing they can really do to try to stop this decline is to reduce their own production in the hope that they can take enough barrels out of the market to slow down the decline in prices. Their problem, though, is that what they're facing here is a falling market. In terms of oil consumption, they're facing, you know, less demand throughout the industrial nations for their product. So it's going to be awfully difficult for OPEC to take out enough barrels from the market to make up for the decline in consumption.
How do we gauge that decline in demand? I mean, you know, if it's really true that the world's demand for oil has dropped by half, I mean, if that's, you know, roughly correlated with the price, I mean, what does that mean in industrial terms? I mean, that's really draconian.
Right. Well, it's not actually. It's the demand and the price aren't really correlated. You mentioned the term schizophrenic to start off, and I think it's pretty apt. The demand has really fallen in industrialized nations. So we had gasoline, you know, consumption in the U.S., for example, dropped by 10% last week compared with the week with the same time last year. In August, Japanese oil consumption fell by 12%. Same in France and other European countries. So you have a very sharp drop off in rich countries. The picture is a little bit more mixed in the developing world, in China and the Middle East, where oil consumption is still growing. The big question this year is going to be, are we going to have a net growth in global oil consumption, or are we going to have a decline in global oil consumption? And so, you know, a decline would be quite dramatic in net oil consumption, and a lot of analysts are actually forecasting that. At minimum, a lot of people are forecasting very weak demand growth both this year and next year.
But the threshold here that you point out, I want to just sort of focus on for a moment, is whether India's and China's growing demand is more to outstrip declining demand elsewhere, or if it just sort of gets buried in the declining demand elessewhere. That's really
the issue.
I mean, four months ago, people were saying it's impossible for any cut in demand in Europe and the United States to put a dent in the Chinese demand, which is insatiable. Now that's a question mark.
Right. That's exactly it. And if you remember, you mentioned those $200 forecasts. Well, the same analysts that had forecast $200 just a few months ago have cut their forecast to $50. You know, in the short to medium term for oil prices, because they're also revising down their demand numbers globally. So,
Jed, you and I, if you and I had to make a correction like that in our careers, we would be fired.
And I was just going to say, that sounds surreal, Jed, to go from $200 to $50. It just doesn't seem possible.
Well, I'm not going to sort of speak for the analysts, but you know, that said, a lot has happened in the past month, and I think if anyone could have forecast, you know, the severity of the financial meltdown and the knock-on effect on the real economy, as per your last speaker, are we in a recession or not yet? It's still an open question. I mean, but you're right. I mean, you know, it's a massive revision, and you know, there was an element of sort of a speculative bubble in commodity markets that, quite frankly, a lot of analysts kind of followed, you know, up through the summer. So,
John, I think it's safe to say that this is something Ron Paul will have to deal with when he's president, right, Jed? Talking about unforeseen circumstances. Jed Mouad, New York Times reporter who covers the energy industry for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us, Jed.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, we're on this odd schedule here at The Takeaway, right, Adora?
I mean,
We get up really, really early. We go to bed at strange sorts of hours. We have, shall we say, sleep issues. But for the population generally, sleep is kind of the daily grim reaper. It's something you can't get out of. You have to address the sleep gods in some way. How many hours of sleep do you get? Is it 8? Is it 5? Is it 3? Do you have special tricks for cheating the sleep gods? I got to drive home from Boston to New York later today, and I don't know how I'm going to do it. Do you have a power nap strategy you'd like to share? I really need your help out there. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Call us or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. We're talking about sleep strategy, sleep tricks. Wasn't there a band called Sleep Trick? No, it was Cheap Trick.
No, I don't think
anyway. We'd like to ask Jim Muir what his sleep strategy is, but there's more important things to talk about with him. Joining us now is Jim Muir, the BBC Baghdad correspondent, to talk about details that are emerging today on a draft agreement to extend the U.S. mandate in Iraq. According to the BBC, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is briefing members of Congress about a deal that would extend the U.S. presence in Iraq until 2011, but would then start a pullout of troops from Iraqi urban areas in the middle of next year. The deal still has to pass muster with the Iraqi parliament, and there have been tense discussions all along as this status of force agreement, as it's called, is facing a end-of-year deadline because the U.N. mandate that authorizes U.S. troops in Iraq runs out at that time. Jim Muir, thanks for joining us.
Most welcome. And I had 2 hours last night, in case you're wondering.
2 hours? Thanks. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for sharing that. Maybe we'll have some time to talk about your sleep tricks. But let's get to the details of this status of force agreement as far as we know it at this point.
Well, as you probably know, the negotiations kicked off early this year, and there were some sticking points. One was over the timeline. The Iraqi government very much wanted to have some kind of timeline in there, and it does have that, getting U.S. forces out of Iraqi cities by June of next year and out of the country altogether. And I think we're talking here about combat troops by the end of 2011. There are also a number of other issues that the Iraqis regarded as key to their sovereignty issues, such as if, for example, American troops were to misbehave when they're off duty, off base, who has jurisdiction over them? Would they face Iraqi courts or what? Well, the Iraqis got that little concession out of the Americans, but it's a bit of a cosmetic one, I think, because I think the U.S. military would regard any of their soldiers in this country at any time as being on mission and therefore not subject to Iraqi jurisdiction. Mm. However, that's been finessed. There's a lot of other detail in it. It's a very detailed agreement, but Iraqi negotiators say this is it. This is the final document. The compromises have been stretched as far as the two sides can go. So it's either take it or leave it at this stage.
A couple of details, Jim. How are the subcontractors, the military subcontractors, dealt with in this agreement? Is it addressed at all, or is it just a gray area?
It is addressed in the sense of they are lumped in with Iraqi military forces in terms of should they be kind of off base and off mission and misbehave, they would be subject to Iraqi law. It is still a bit of a gray area because, as you probably know, the Iraqis did produce legislation that would bring contractors, security contractors, under Iraqi law, because there have been a number of fairly notorious cases where Iraqi civilians have been killed by what they regard, or the Iraqi authorities regard, as trigger-happy private security details. And that is still, I think, a bit of a gray area.
So how does this agreement reveal, in any sense, the military strategy that the Pentagon has going forward in Iraq? Or is this mostly a political deal, insofar as you can tell?
It is a very detailed, basically military deal, and it foresees the kind of transition that that everybody has in mind, whereby U.S. forces would be phased out of direct frontline combat roles and more into logistics, training, backup, air power, heavy firepower, and so on when needed. So it is that kind of transition that seems to be built into this accord. It's been a very, very hard wrangle, this accord. The Americans have, I think I'm right in thinking, at least 80 other SOFAs, that status of forces agreements, in other countries, but none of them where they're in a combat role. So this has proven a very tricky one, especially with the Iraqi government feeling under pressure to safeguard those sovereignty items and to assert itself as an independent government.
And in some real sense, this dovetails with the emerging notion that things are actually improving in the security situation on the ground in Iraq, as David Petraeus, the general, went off to CENTCOM, and there's been a change of leadership in Iraq. It seems to be consistent with the good news that's been emerging from Iraq. True?
Yes, no question about it, but nobody's complacent at all. And yes, all the statistics are down, the numbers of attacks of all kinds, the numbers of casualties of all kinds, but you yet to get that sense of a real country pulling together at the center. A lot of the legislation that's supposed to be nation building is held up. There's a lot of bickering going on, a lot of fragmentation in the political arena, and I have to say, it's by no means an assured item that this agreement will go through. On the Iraqi side, there's very strong opposition. There's going to be a big demonstration tomorrow, that's Saturday, by Muqtada Sadr's supporters, your grassroots Shiites, who are against any continuing American presence. Iran is huffing and puffing on the borders. They're very hostile as well. So, as I say, it's by no means a done deal that it will actually get approved by the Iraqi side. It has to go through Parliament, and there are a lot of people there who will want to tear bits of it off it.
Jim, you were, before we go, as Middle Eastern correspondents, both of us, we've spent a fair amount of time in tents and trying to grab sleep here and there while doing stories that are more or less 24 hours. Any sleep strategy you'd like to share with me? I never got a chance to ask you when we were together over in Iran and Lebanon.
I'm afraid I'm one of those people who just hasn't got a very good strategy. I tend to, when I'm really having to work really, really hard, just to forget about sleep and then hope I'll catch up later, but I very rarely do, so I'm often running on empty on that one.
So, Jim, you are part android, I guess it's fair to say.
Sometimes one goes on to autopilot. In fact, yeah, I have been described as an automaton, yep.
Automaton. Proudly an automaton. Jim Muir, BBC Baghdad correspondent, thanks for joining us on any level. We've been asking you this hour for tips on how to cheat sleep. What's your strategy? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Now, wake up Femi Oke and get her in here to do the headlines.
Yeah,
Femi?
Thanks. I was just falling asleep there, John. Thanks for that. 29 minutes past the hour. European markets opened around 2% higher today, buoyed by yesterday's rally in the US. Three mortgage banks could face criminal charges, according to a federal investigator. A grand jury is looking into whether banks Countrywide, New Century Financial and IndyBank Bank Corp committed mortgage fraud and other white-collar crimes. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir opened a peace summit on Darfur yesterday, even though the rebels fighting the government are protesting the meetings. And President Bashir is currently under investigation for genocide in Sudan's troubled western region of Darfur. And after spending close to $8 million, California is very close to containing the wildfires that have been raging since Sunday. Firefighters have contained 90% of a large fire in San Diego County. And that's a look at some of the headlines making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
Thanks, Pam.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Voting is precious for us here at The Takeaway. That's why America's Exit Poll is telling stories of early voters who made up their minds. Here's Doug's story.
I was an extra on a TV show, right? I was a limousine driver, and I had to sit there in the cold for hours. And on the radio, I picked up a town hall style debate that Barack Obama was doing in the primaries. And the way that I listened to him speak and address the questions from the audience and just speak honestly and openly and plainly to people, and I just said, that's my man. He's got to be the president.
Well, Obama did not approve this message, but here at The Takeaway, we're conducting an exit poll of early voters from all across the country. What was the moment when you made your decision on who to vote for? And tell us how you voted if you were an early voter. Democracy's hotline is 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's America's exit poll on The Takeaway. Hadora?
And John, right now we're going to take a look at how those votes are going to be counted in what many predict will be a record-breaking turnout year. Records have already been broken in new voters registering, nearly 2 million of them across the country. And more states this year have opened early polls. And this week, accusations have been flying about voter fraud and illegal purging of voter rolls. Despite all the accusations, though, Professor Nate Persily from Columbia University School of Law argues that fraud is the least of our worries. Professor, what should we be worried about?
I think that the so-called fraud integrity debate is actually a distraction from what are going to be the real problems this time. And a lot of that is the garden variety problems that we see every election, but magnified by the enormous turnout that we're going to see, particularly in significant African-American precincts.
So give us that list.
Well, one thing one has to sort of look at is that there are a lot of states that are grappling with new technological challenges this time. Several states are looking at new voter registration databases that they've never used before, statewide voter registration databases, as well as new types of technology, whether it's electronic voting machines, optical scan, et cetera. You have a largely untrained and unfamiliar poll worker administration class of people who are going to be confronting record numbers of voters using those new technologies and using those new systems. And that's when we look at things like voter ID and the purges and other things, we're talking maybe in the low, you know, hundreds or thousands of people. But these types of problems are going to be the things that produce very long lines in areas where we see the high turnout.
Well, let's look at some numbers for a second. In Ohio, there are 700,000 new voters, Florida 500,000, and Colorado 300,000 new voters. And I pick those three states because many are talking about them as being particularly troublesome. Have those states spent money and time on A, educating their poll workers, and B, in preparing for what is expected to be many, many voters?
They've done their best. And I have to say that the turnout's going to be large across the board. We're going to see problems in even the so-called sort of safe states, the very blue or the very red states. The problem is we're not going to care about them as much because they won't potentially be determinative of the outcome, and they won't be the states that people are watching. But Ohio right now there's about a lawsuit a day there where the parties are going back and forth over various machinations that are happening between the Secretary of State's office and the county's boards of elections. I tend to think that Ohio, so many people are watching Ohio that they are actually a little bit better prepared than other places, but it remains to be seen. And we know that there were huge lines in 2004 in Ohio when we were watching them as well. And so I think it's likely there. I also think the new battleground states, which have never been prepared for this kind of scrutiny, places like North Carolina, Virginia, and Colorado are places that we sort of have to keep our eye on. Some of those states, particularly Colorado, New Mexico, if I had had to pick it before this election, would have been the place I would have looked at most of all because of the variation in the counties there and how they're going to be administering the election.
Professor, I'm just going to suggest that you restrain from making some predictions, because when we get to the end of this interview, I'm going to remind you about something that you said to us many months ago. But first, let me ask you about how do you think all of these states offering early voting is going to affect counting of the vote? Is it going to alleviate some of these issues that you're talking about?
Yes. If I had sort of one piece of advice is in those states where you can vote early or there's no fault absentee, that is a lifting of a great burden on the system this year, is how many places you can do that in. In fact, in some states like New Mexico, Colorado, and Montana, the battleground states, you're going to have over 40% of the votes are going to be cast earlier absentee. Places like Oregon, where it's going to be completely absentee, and even in California, where maybe a third of the ballots are going to be cast absentee.
Okay, and I guess I should have said refrain as opposed to restrain, but I think you told us back in April that Indiana was not going to be a terribly competitive state.
Well, my feeling about that is that if it is a competitive state, then this election is over. Because if Barack Obama is tied with McCain in Indiana, frankly, he's won, you know, many more electoral votes than it's going to make a difference. So, yeah, it is possible that Indiana is close, although I tend to think that it's not as close as people are saying. But if it is, then you know, we have answered the election administrator's prayer, which is what they pray before Election Day is, God, let it not be close. And so... if that actually is competitive, then this election is over.
Professor, I feel your pain. You have to watch what you say around Adore Udoji. I live that every single day.
Well, I should say that was in the context of talking about the voter ID debate. And one thing we did learn from the primary election is that there are many fewer voters than some might have expected who faced voter ID problems at the polls. The best estimates are around 500 people, which, you know, is still a large number of people, but as a percent of the voting population, quite small, who showed up to the polls with without an ID that would satisfy the Indiana voter ID law.
Well, Professor, thanks for joining us. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
That's our friend, Professor Nate Persily, Professor of Law at Columbia University. And now we're going to turn things over to Femi Oke, who's got a few headlines for us.
Thanks, Adora. It's just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush will speak from the White House in a few minutes, and he's going to address specifics of the first $250 billion chunk to be distributed to the nation's banks. A draft agreement with Iraq could see U.S. troops withdrawn from the country in 3 years' time. The Iraqi military has gradually been taking on more responsibility from the United States for security and also benefiting from Western training. General Frank Helmuck is commander of the NATO training mission in Iraq.
We're not where we want to be. We're not where we need to be. But thank goodness we're not where we used to be.
And the Pentagon has yet to release details of the draft agreement to pull out of Iraq, and Iraqi politicians must agree the deal. Just a quick correction, apologies about this. President Bush will speak from the Chamber of Commerce, not from the White House, as I said just a few moments ago. The Commerce Department reports that the number of new houses being built are down 6.3%. That's the lowest level since 1991. The credit crisis and the huge number of foreclosed houses on the market has hurt construction projects. And Americans are driving less. That means they're using less oil, which means the price is going down. And it's now below $70 a barrel. That's the lowest it's been in 14 months. And that's a look at your news making headlines this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adore Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and here's a voice from the Patchwork Nation.
I believe Mr. Obama pays more attention to what could be done to remedy the problem. I think Senator McCain kind of delved into it a little bit, but he really didn't follow through.
The issue that he's discussing, that's Roy Delgado, former mayor of El Mirage, a city in Arizona. The issue he's discussing is immigration. And Roy Delgado is a member of the Immigration Nation slice of the Patchwork Nation, which is a project of the Christian Science Monitor. And the director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation project is Dante Chinney, who joins us once again. Dante, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Let me just explain. Patchwork Nation is a way of slicing up America, not into electoral designations, states, red states, blue states, but into communities which reflect more issues and non-geographic designations that maybe are even more critical in the election. Tell me about Immigration Nation and who does it consist of?
Well, it's about 12 million people in 140-odd counties, mostly around the Southwest, but scattered in other states, too. They're fascinating. Places like North Carolina, Michigan has some, Wisconsin has some. These are places with, you know, large Hispanic populations, Latino populations. And there are a lot of tensions in these places. The immigration issue runs very hot here. And it's what people vote on, and it also just kind of affects, immigration kind of affects everything that goes on in these places.
But it would be wrong to describe the Immigration Nation group as a single-issue constituency, true?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this issue, immigration, colors a lot of other issues, but those issues matter. I mean, the economy is a big issue in Immigration Nation. These are not wealthy communities. These are the median below the national average. But you know, immigration ends up coloring the way the economy plays out. For instance, if I'm a business owner, there have been a lot of crackdowns in these communities, in particular on illegals. And they don't know who to hire. They don't know if they can hire people. And that starts to trickle down to the economy. Even legal immigrants, they just don't know if they want to take a chance in hiring. That means those people have fewer dollars to spend. And you start to see it flow throughout the community. Increasingly, it's a problem.
So certainly the commercial paper market isn't something that's on the minds of these people, but the impacts of the financial crisis are already being felt, is what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, these are more the short term, you know, kind of the bump in gas prices, the increase in food prices. That's really what's hammered these places hard. And no, these aren't places where people are opening up their 401k statements right now and scratching their heads because most people don't have 401k statements in these places. But you know, it is starting to trickle down. The concerns that other people have, the concerns that people with more money have, end up, you know, this is the place where the trickle-down recession trickles down, too, when it comes to the Wall Street part of it.
Now, your correspondent there, Roy Delgado from Arizona, suggests that McCain hasn't dealt seriously with immigration. Is there a way of saying, quickly before we go, if this group is skewing towards Obama or towards McCain?
It does seem, you know, Bush won this group in 2004. It does seem right now that it's skewing toward Obama. I think it's largely on economic issues, and I do think that in some ways they do feel a little betrayed on the immigration issue with McCain.
And so the question is, if Immigration Nation is moving, that's going to move some pivotal states. Certainly we've been
Absolutely.
Talking about New Mexico, possibly Colorado. Dante Chinney, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dante Chinney, of course, is the director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation, which you can find on our website at thetakeaway.org, another way of looking at electoral America.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It is Friday, October 17th, and Femi Oke has just joined us, and she's got the latest headlines of the hour.
Thank you very much, Dora. Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour, President Bush is at the Chamber of the Commerce, currently speaking now. He's saying that the nation is dealing with a serious financial crisis. Meanwhile, yesterday, the price of oil dipped below $70 a barrel for the first time in 14 months, nearly half the price it was over the summer. It's now hovering around $71 a barrel. The markets are expected to open lower today. The Commerce Department reports on housing figures this morning. Iran is competing with Japan for a seat on the UN Security Council. The council will elect members to the 10 rotating seats, and Japan has served on the council for 9 terms. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens testifies today in the corruption trial against him. He's accused of not reporting $250,000 in gifts. He testified yesterday that an oil executive ordered up expensive renovations to Stevens's home without telling him.
I hate that when that happens. It's so annoying.
But you come
oil
home.
Oil executives, like I come home and there's like these oil executives in my house.
The carpets
like
have changed.
The wallpaper. Yeah.
Wallpaper's like, different. Nice new furniture.
Okay, all right, yeah. All right. Okay, yeah. All
right. I'll give them your address. Leno Letterman and SNL, the candidates, are doing the late night show rounds at the moment. Last night, Joe Biden dropped into The Tonight Show and he talked about his good friend, John McCain.
I don't think John's comfortable with the negative stuff and the advertising that his campaign uses. And I think John is really sort of, he seems a little more angry than he usually is.
And John McCain.
He said than he usually
than
is?
He usually is.
I see.
And he's a good friend of John McCain, so he would know what his usual self would be. And John McCain actually turned up on The Late Show with David Letterman 3 weeks after he cancelled at short notice. And Letterman teased the senator about standing him up.
Maybe I'm just not important enough.
Can I give you an answer?
Please.
I screwed up.
Senator McCain talked about taxes, the economic crisis, and confirmed that his running mate Sarah Palin will be on Saturday Night Live this weekend. And that's a look at all of your news for now.
Very quickly, Femi, you get enough sleep?
Never, ever. I sleep at the weekend and I don't sleep during the week. That's why I'm so nice and friendly.
You may actually get more sleep than you think, and that applies to you too, John. Chances are, if you're like most people, you probably woke up this morning a little earlier than you'd like, and last night you went to bed later than you should. But new research suggests that although you may be a little sleepy this afternoon, you're not necessarily sleep-deprived. Jim Horn is the director of the Sleep Research Center at Loughborough University in the UK. He joins us from his home. Good morning.
Good morning.
So explain the difference. If I'm feeling sleepy, how is that not sleep deprivation?
Well, it could be, but we all experience a little sleepiness in the day. It all depends where you are. If you're sitting in the afternoon doing very little in a comfortable chair, then you'll start feeling sleepy after 10 minutes. But if you're up and about, you won't. So to some extent, our sleepiness depends on the environment. In the same way, so does hunger. If you're busy and doing other things, you don't feel very hungry. But as soon as you pass a restaurant or smell the sight of food, you suddenly realize you're hungry. And so to some extent, our sleepiness depends on where we are. But in generally speaking, most people, if they're not sleepy when they're normally active in the day, apart from a bit of a dip in the afternoon and at bedtime, then the sleep they're getting is probably adequate. I think there's too many people worried about not getting enough sleep, and there's quite a bit of fear-mongering going on at the moment, especially in the UK, about the consequences of being suffering from sleep debt. And I think it's no worse than it was. And if you go back into the medical journals and magazines going back 100 years, even in America, you see people have been complaining about lack of sleep and sleeplessness, and potions for curing sleeplessness and insomnia have been with us for 2,000 years. People
potions? Did you say, wait a second, Professor, you said potions? Where would I get those?
Well, they were. We used to use laudanum, which was a mixture of alcohol and opium, which is very, very common in Europe up to about 100 years ago.
Huh. So essentially, you think that it's all a bunch of hooey.
I think the real issue is that many people who do have insomnia do worry about their sleep. And what I'm trying to say is that if you do have insomnia and you're not particularly sleepy in the day, then probably the sleep you're getting is adequate. It's not nice, I know, not sufficient. But then one of the problems is that people with insomnia often start worrying about not getting enough sleep and whether the lack of sleep is going to cause them damage or illness.
How much sleep are you talking about when you're talking about enough? Is it five hours or six hours or eight hours a night?
Well, the average amount of sleep most adults take in the UK is about 7 hours a night. So generally speaking, it's the quality also of sleep. It's not so much how much, but whether your sleep is restful and undisturbed. So you could have 10 hours of disturbed sleep if you've got children and noise around, and you still just feel just as bad after you had this 10 hours disturbed sleep as you were before you started. But if it's good quality sleep, uninterrupted sleep, then most people can function pretty well between 6 and 7.5 hours sleep a night. Most adults, that is.
Professor, what is the organic threshold that you cross when sleep goes from being, you know, something we might slide into if we're not distracted in a comfortable chair, as you say, to being overwhelming, where, like, every waking moment you're thinking about, could I put my head down there? Could I put my head down there? Could I put my head down there? Well, what's going on when it's overwhelming and you can't think of anything else but sleep?
Well, that is very often associated with a very, very disturbed sleep. And one of the causes, for example, is very heavy snoring. And although many people think snoring is a bit of a joke, but for some people it's very serious indeed, and their breathing is very obstructed, and the snoring is actually due to a momentary awakening during sleep in order to breathe properly. And that causes terrible sleep disturbance. And people with this, of course, obstructive sleep apnea may appear to sleep quite contentedly for 10 hours a night, but still wake up very, very sleepy in the daytime. And it's overwhelming sleepiness. They're falling asleep all the time. As soon as they sit down and do very little, they fall asleep. And this is clearly something seriously wrong with their sleep. And they may, even though they may be getting 10 hours of sleep, it might be very, very disturbed. On the other hand, if you really, if you sleep well, but only getting less than 5 hours a night, generally speaking, when you go below 5 hours per night, even though it might be quite good sleep, for most people that would mean they're going to be pretty sleepy throughout most of the day.
So when go ahead, John.
What about a power nap? If you take a 10-minute power nap, what does that do to you that rejuvenates you? Why does that work?
That's very good. Well, we've done a lot of work on power naps, and if you have poor sleep or insufficient sleep at night, then a short ziz in the afternoon for about 15 minutes can be very refreshing indeed. It should be less than, keep it less than 20 minutes, because if you're not used to having a nap in the afternoon, if it goes beyond about 15 and 20 minutes, it develops into full-blown sleep. And if you wake up after having an hour sleep in the afternoon, you're not used to it, you wake up feeling very groggy and thick-headed. It's rather like a sort of form of jet lag, so it's a bit counterproductive, but a quick 15-minute ziz, when sometimes you're not even sure you've been asleep but feel better afterwards, so that can be very refreshing.
That's great. Well, wake me up in 10 after, okay, Adora? I'm out. See you later. Bye, sweetie.
I'll wake you up. So, Professor, what's your advice then?
My advice about...
About sleeping. Don't worry about it. Get your 7 hours and you'll be fine?
Yes, I think the acid test of insufficient sleep is whether you are sleepy throughout most of the day, not just the dip in the afternoon and at bedtime. And if you are fairly alert, able to do your job pretty effectively and your home work at home or whatever throughout the rest of the day, then without falling asleep, then the sleep you're getting is adequate. And don't worry about it. I think people are worrying too much about sleep and listening too much to the media saying that if you don't get 8 hours sleep or whatever, you're going to go down some terrible illness. But of course, the worst thing can happen if you go without sleep. You're very sleepy in the days. You'll have a sleep-related vehicle crash. And in the States, of course, this is a problem. People driving through the night with very, very little sleep.
And sleep deprivation, I mean, what does it do to your body when you truly are, when you truly do have that sleep debt?
Well, the sleep debt, when it gets very serious, the effect is much, much more on the brain than the body, as we know, that not only do you become sleepy, but even if you start taking, if you're very, very sleep deprived, start taking coffee, for example, even though the sleepiness that tends to disappear, your thinking is still affected. Your thinking is less, you tend to forget things more quickly, you tend to be more irritable, and also you're less able to deal with novelty, the unexpected. You become more like a zombie, basically. The more sleep deprived you are, even though the coffee will make you stop you from falling asleep, but your brain can't think in the active way and respond to new things.
I think I've had that feeling a few times. Professor Jim Horn, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Professor Jim Horn of the Sleep Research Center at Loughborough University. Get some sleep.
We're always on.
Yeah,
right?
We're talking politics on our election website. Join the conversation at vote2008.thetakeaway.org. We're also talking about sleep. And I forgot I was supposed to wake you up, but I see you're with us. We're asking you for tips on how to get a good night's snooze.
Hey, my name is Charlie Frick. I am from Passaic, New Jersey, and I learned this trick when I was in the music business many years ago, working with bands and in clubs. The trick is you have to eat breakfast before you go to bed in the middle of the night. This way you have an extra hour to sleep in the morning when you wake up, because you don't have to eat breakfast.
Well, there you go. Bingo. Thanks for that. We want to know what your sleeping tricks are. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Americans are, by nature, optimistic. Isn't that what the candidates tell us?
I'm surprised that only 80% claim it's going bad. I would expect it to be more than that, because the country really has gone to the pot.
Look at all the lovely people. So the BBC charters a bus and drives across the country talking to depressed Americans about the election. How is that helping? Talking America, going in the wrong direction, British invasion. Remember when it was just the Beatles? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 17th. And boy, I hope everyone they met wasn't so down. What do you think, John?
Good morning, Adora. Yeah, the BBC, you know, they chartered this bus and they've been driving. I think it's Aerosmith's old bus. They've been driving around the country. They just ended their trip. It's amazing.
Okay, well, we'll see what they say. This morning, we'll preview Democrats' efforts to pick up seats in Congress, and we'll hear how one phone call changed American history. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
President Bush spoke this morning in advance of the market's opening in an effort to ease the minds of investors about government efforts to heal the economy. He didn't have any new proposals, but he did ask for patience. The president spoke just a few minutes ago.
People look at this crisis and say, oh, it's only to Wall Street. I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I know that if we had not acted, it was going to affect the American people directly. The actions will take more time to have their full impact. Took a while for the credit system to freeze up. It's going to take a while for the credit system to thaw.
The president spoke in front of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Futures point to a lower opening for Wall Street. A new housing starts report is just moving the markets. It shows new construction down 6.3%. That's worse than expected. Contractors don't start constructing homes until they think they can sell, so the market seems to be weak. European markets are doing okay this morning. Key indices in the UK, Germany, and France have all moved up. No such luck in Asia. Most markets down there. Japan's Nikkei managed to climb, though. It closed up 2.8% after historic drops this week.
American and Iraqi negotiators are closer to finalizing a critical deal on the American military presence in Iraq. Both governments have agreed on a draft agreement that includes a timeline for U.S. withdrawal by 2012. Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell says it's still just a draft.
We are close, but not at the final status yet.
The Bush administration wants to get the deal done before the U.N. agreement on American troops in Iraq expires at the end of the year. John, you're in Boston, right?
That's right, where the hometown Red Sox shocked the Tampa Bay Rays in baseball's American League Championship, coming back from a 7-run deficit in the seventh inning. I mean, that's lucky sevens, huh?
Sounds
the Rays
dramatic.
Lead the series 3-2. Oh, it's very, very dramatic, and the entire city is like on cloud nine today. The winner plays the Philadelphia Phillies in the World Series. That series between the Rays and the Sox shifts to Florida now. It's an exit poll of early voters on The Takeaway, though, right?
It is. We want to hear why you chose the candidate, when you chose the candidate, if you've chosen the candidate. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Early voting. We're polling you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. There are not many things that Democrats and Republicans tend to agree on, but in this election year, they do agree on this, that Democrats are expected to make significant gains in the House and in the Senate. The question is, how many seats? Earlier this week, we interviewed Republican Representative Tom Cole, the chairman of the party's congressional election efforts, and today we speak to his Democratic counterpart, Congressman Chris Van Hollen, the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
So there's an ailing economy and a young popular presidential candidate, Barack Obama. Which do you think is driving all of this talk that you could pick up many House seats and potentially a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. You've got the fact that people around the country are fed up with the last 8 years of the policies of the Bush administration, especially with regards to the economy. and you've got lots of Republican incumbent members of Congress that have been voting in lockstep with the president's economic policies for the last many years. And so people are fed up, of course, with where those policies have landed the country, which has essentially driven us into the ditch, and they're looking for change. You have on top of that Barack Obama generating an awful lot of excitement and energy out there, and a sense that the Republicans are just a little bit out of touch with respect to how to respond to the economic situation. You had John McCain saying not too long ago that fundamentals of the economy were sound, and you've got a lot of Republican candidates who haven't really offered anything different than the Bush proposals going forward.
How do you respond to the notion that some people are voting against Republicans as opposed to voting for Democrats?
Well, there's always a combination of motivations and feelings when people go into the voting booth. I think a good part of it, of course, is the fact that they're fed up with what the Bush administration has brought us. But I do believe that there have been some important changes made with the new Congress. After all, the new Congress just came to power, so to speak, in the last election, 2006, in a short period of time, has been able to make progress on things like finally increasing the fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. That was a long overdue thing.
Mm-hmm.
We cut in half the interest rate on student loans. We passed for the first time what outside watchdog groups described as landmark lobbying and ethics reform. So there have been some important and solid improvements. On the other hand, we've been blocked by primarily Republicans in the Senate and the President on things like children's health care.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to expand that, and of course trying
can
to bring an end to the war in Iraq.
Can you specifically talk about those races that you think are most competitive, or those races that you're actually surprised that Democrats are competitive in right now?
Well, I mean, most of the races Democrats are involved in right now running in terms of new challenges are seats that George Bush carried in past presidential elections. So in that sense, almost every seat that Democrats are competing in is tough political territory historically. But what's happened is that, number one, we have some very strong and solid candidates that were recruited early on that's put together organizations to get their message out. And you've got this sense out there among the public that they're fed up with the representation from the incumbents who were voting for the Bush policy. So the short answer to your question is that we've got about 50 seats around this country that are
5-0
in play. Now, that's just in play. That means that we have strong candidates and competitive races. We're also, of course, having to defend some seats. After all, the Democrats picked up a net of 30 seats in the House of Representatives last time, and picked up a number, of course, in the Senate as well. And so you have to defend and hold on to those seats that
were also
in tough territory. But that, the story of this election, as you suggested, is that Democrats are now in a position to pick up seats. And the reason that's a big story is that historically, after one party picks up lots of seats in a wave election, like the Democrats did in 2006.
Thank you very much, Maryland Representative Chris Van Hollen, chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. John?
Talking about the potential for some pretty extraordinary gains by the Democrats in the House and Senate. Well, the economy's numbers are reaching Main Street, and we had no better evidence of that than the housing decline. 6.3% new housing construction declined today, and analysts were expecting a decline of only about 1.6%, so that's much, much bigger than expected. It is one statistic in a whole range of statistics this week which indicate at least the presence of a recession. Now, the depth and persistence of that recession, well, we'll have to ask David Weiss, an economist at Standard & Poor's, chief economist at Standard & Poor's, who joins me on the line from Washington. David, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
So housing construction really goes in lockstep with dropping oil and copper prices. These are also recessionary indicators. The jobs report was flat, but still not terribly positive. Any indication of whether the recession that we're talking about is more of an episode or much more persistent and deep?
Oh, I think this is going to be a very lengthy recession, and I think the best numbers are the employment numbers that indicate that. We've lost jobs for 9 consecutive months. The unemployment rate's up to 6.1%. That's a pretty long recession already, and we think it's only about half over.
And we were talking to an economist earlier this morning who was saying that if you do add up all those jobs over the last 9 months, that this begins to look like one of the more serious recessions in comparison with, say, the last century.
I'm not sure it'll be that bad because the actual job losses are still not that big. We're only down 760,000 jobs. We've gotten that in a couple of months in some other recessions. But it's the persistence is what bothers you, and I think that indicates a lengthy recession. Probably, I don't think it'll be that deep a recession. I think it'll be a moderate recession, certainly worse than 2001, but probably more in line with the 91-92 downturn.
Is there some way of saying that this represents something of an employment correction in that the historic low numbers of unemployment that we saw throughout the 90s and really over the past several years are not likely to be revisited again anytime soon?
I wouldn't go that far, but I think it's going to be a while before we get them down. We're looking for the unemployment rate to peak up around 7.5%, which is certainly very high and well above the historical average, but you know, we were up over 10% in 1982 or in 1975.
And, you know, talk a little bit about commodity prices. I kind of went on a tear yesterday going into all kinds of arcane statistics regarding, you know, shipping around the world. It does appear, according to some commodities analysts, that a lot of economic activity that's associated particularly with construction has ground to a halt, and it's not just in the United States. Is that what you're seeing?
No, this is an industrial country recession. We're seeing downturns in Europe. We're seeing downturns in Japan. Europe had the same overbuilding and overpriced housing that the United States had, and they're suffering from a lot of the same problems that we are. Japan didn't really have that problem, but, you know, the high oil prices were a big problem for them because they import basically all their energy.
So now we have lower oil prices, and as we've talked about, this is a recessionary indicator, but might it also be an engine for a restart of the economy?
Yeah, low oil prices will help. A lot of the damage last summer was caused by the high oil prices, which cut back on people's purchasing power. With oil coming back down, purchasing power goes up. People can spend more at the shopping mall, and I think early next year we'll start to see consumer spending coming back up.
The numbers that we saw this week, a decline in consumer spending or retail spending, which was a three-year low,
yes.
Does that worry you about the Christmas season?
Oh, no question. I think we're in for a really bad Christmas season. I don't think people are going to be spending much money. They're not going to be borrowing much money. Credit card utilization is coming down. They're becoming a lot more cautious, both the people and the banks. It's hard to tell which is which here.
You know, we were discussing a kind of psychology of recession where people's hesitancy gets compounded and everybody is just sort of holding back and not making economic decisions. That's hard to reverse with things like stimulus packages. Do you see any sort of short-term way of addressing the psychology of recession?
The stimulus packages do work because if people have money, they will go out and spend it. But you're right, psychology isn't a big part of this. People get scared. They crawl into their shell, and they don't want to spend money. Usually, as long as that's not reinforced by income loss, by job loss, they come out of their shells fairly quickly. But right now, of course, we're still looking at an unemployment rate that's going to rise by over another percentage point over the next year.
You got a long Christmas list there, David?
Well, I've
checking
got
it twice.
I've got a fourth grandkid showing up, so.
Yeah, you don't have any choice.
Yeah, that requires a lot of spending.
Yeah, the Weiss family is the engine of the economy this season. David Weiss, chief economist at Standard & Poor's, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Talking about what is apparently a persistent recession showing signs in economic statistics on Wall Street.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji
from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 17th, and John Hockenberry, I want you to close your eyes and try to imagine a journey of 4,000 miles and 38 days in a bus, but there's a catch, with your colleagues.
That sounds like my summer vacation with my kids in the minivan.
Right, it is something like that. Our partners at the BBC, they've done just that. They've made that trip. In the run-up to the presidential election, the BBC's Talking America bus crossed the country to get the pulse of the folks who are going to be voting. Steve Evans, presenter of Business Daily on World Service, and Chloe Haji-Meyetheu, producer with Talking America. They join us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Morning.
So, Steve, let's start with you. How would you sum up your time on that bus? Where have you been and what have you seen?
Now, I only joined the thing at Nashville. Chloe joined it right at the start in Los Angeles. But we've seen a very, very varied picture of America. It's great, really, because it's the kind of thing that journalists don't normally do. We don't normally go to places where the story isn't, as it were, and just go to out-the-way places and talk to ordinary people and get their concerns. So very, very varied voices, intensely varied voices, from all sides and no side, just giving us opinions and giving us colour. So it's been great. We came through Nashville, Gettysburg, where we talked to some veterans of the Vietnam War, some veterans of the coal industry in West Virginia, and then right up to New York, and we talked to some people in a Brooklyn diner yesterday. So it's all kinds of people.
And
did you find a lot of anger about King George as you went from town to town?
We did. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we want the country back. There's no doubt of that. And I think there are people out there who are ready to give it back, you know. The other great scandal about this country is the complete absence of decent cups of tea.
Chloe, on a more serious note, did you learn something or have you learned something on this trip that was or is unexpected to you?
I think we arrived thinking that foreign policy might be a more important issue to America. And obviously things have heated up now and taken a different turn of events. But 6 weeks ago when we started on this trip, we thought that foreign policy was going to be a deciding factor perhaps in this election. And it's been the economy all over. Everywhere we've gone, people's pockets are hurting and people's personal lives are being affected. And we've picked up a lot of very personal stories and individual stories as we've gone round. And that has been the overriding picture across America. The economy is what people care about.
Let's listen to a clip that your colleague Roz Atkins got in Kingman, Arizona. He was talking to a man named Roger.
I'm surprised that only 80% claim it's we're going bad. I would expect it to be more than that, because the country really has gone to the pot.
And Roger there was referring to a story in the New York Times that said 80% of Americans felt like the country was going in the wrong direction. So, Chloe, is that much of what you've been hearing, particularly in the last couple of weeks?
Actually, that poll was one of the reasons we decided to embark on this trip. And we have actually felt that. We felt that Americans are incredibly proud of their country. They love America very much, and they love living here. They wouldn't be anywhere else. But right now, they don't see it as good times. Right now is a hard patch. They know that. And they know that it's going to last quite a long time. And they're not happy also with the image that America has internationally. So there are lots of factors at the moment that are making Americans unhappy and want change. They all want change. They have very different ideas about what that change is, but they all want it.
Steve, I'm going to let you have the final word before we go. How would you sum up perceptions about the presidential election?
Absolutely everybody says it's a big deal. And this idea that voters don't care about politics, it seems to me, is fanciful. You know, people come up to the bus. A lot of people come up to the bus and they want to tell us. It's almost as though they feel shamefaced about the image of America. Chloe was talking about there. People want to vote, though. The thing I found most shocking, I have to say, though, is a white man telling me he's not going to vote for Obama because he's not going to vote for a Negro. And I came away from that interview genuinely shocked. It's one of the most shocking things I've ever come across in journalism. Now, having said that, I talked to four
old elderly black men in Brooklyn yesterday, and they can't quite believe what they think might be about to happen. And so I suppose that was the uplift to the downside from the previous interview. So it's, you know, uplifting. All that pride you've got in your country is absolutely fabulous, but there's a dark side too.
Thank you both. But just very quickly, I've heard a rumor. Is it true the bus you're on used to be Aerosmith's tour bus?
Well, I was told that.
No?
And also Cher's.
Cher.
Exactly.
Well, they certainly know how to ride in style. Thanks for joining us, Steve Evans, presenter of Business Daily on World Service, and Chloe Hajimathayu, producer with Talking America. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us.
Thank you very much, Adora. It is 26 minutes past the hour. Good morning. European stock markets are up around about 2% following yesterday's rally in the US. Three mortgage banks could face criminal charges. A grand jury in Los Angeles is investigating banks Countrywide, New Century Financial, and IndyMac Bank Corp for mortgage fraud and other white-collar crimes. Weaker winds are helping firefighters control wildfires in California, and they've totally contained three fires in the San Fernando Valley north of Los Angeles. A new peace conference on Darfur is underway in the capital of Sudan, but the rebels at odds with the government are protesting the conference. Sudan's president is being investigated for genocide. Tainted Chinese milk products have been found in Italy. The Italian health ministry found the lethal chemical melamine in three illegally imported containers of milk and yogurt. And finally, a classic 70s track is turning into the perfect training tour. Let's bring on the Bee Gees. The University of Illinois College of Medicine at Peoria have found that students and doctors can do perfect CPR by keeping to the beat. 103 beats per minute, and this song stays in your head. And if your heart ever stops, you need one of those students to help you out. They're going to sing the Bee Gees, and there you go. You'll be staying alive.
Push, blow, spit, push. Blow, spin. There you go.
I'm digging out my white pants right now. Let's look at your news.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
God, that's crazy. Well, you hear a lot about exit polls during election season, and we have an election, an exit poll going right now for all the early voters in the nation. The polls are open. Listen.
Hi, my name's Kelly. I'm a military dependent and have already voted absentee in Texas. We voted for Obama, my husband and I both did. Kind of go against the grain in the military. Most of our friends do not feel the same way we do politically. We are independent voters. But I've liked McCain in the past, just not this incarnation of McCain.
That's right. We're exit polling all you early voters. Tell us the story of how you made up your mind and how you actually went to the polls and voted. 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's America's exit poll right here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So sit back now and let me tell you a yarn of the 1960 presidential campaign. It's a story about how small events sometimes can have giant consequences and that tests of leadership don't always announce themselves. In the last weeks of the Kennedy-Nixon campaign in 1960, the race was neck and neck. Both candidates had vowed to support the growing civil rights movement. Both Nixon and Kennedy had pledged to seek the support of black voters all across America. But on October 19th, 48 years ago this weekend, there was an arrest in Georgia. Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested along with 52 other protesters at a lunch counter in Rich's department store in Atlanta. King was held over the weekend, and while the other protesters were released, King was sentenced to 4 months hard labor and whisked off to the state pen.
This was long before Dr. King was a world-renowned peace advocate and civil rights leader, and in 1960, for a rebellious African-American to be locked away in the state penitentiary in Georgia for any length of time was no simple matter. Observers openly feared King might not come out of that prison alive. Three Southern governors had already told the Kennedy campaign, long before the arrest of King, that any attempt to stir up black voters in the South during a campaign with appeals to civil rights would be met by opposition. The Democrats would lose the South, they threatened. So, what to do? In the Nixon Justice Department, an obscure official named Lawrence Walsh issued a directive. The Eisenhower administration should file a friend of the court brief demanding King's release. Lawrence Walsh, he would be a major figure in the Iran-Contra affair. But back then, he was just in the Justice Department issuing a memo. Memos were sent to the Vice President Nixon and President Eisenhower. Meanwhile, in the Kennedy campaign, an obscure fellow named Harris Wofford, who would someday be a senator from Pennsylvania. He was then a professor at Notre Dame and a campaign worker. He had an idea. Kennedy should call Dr. King's wife, 6 months pregnant, and express concern and openly call for King's release. Wofford had to reach the candidate, though. Time was of the essence. They were campaigning around the clock. Wofford's boss, Sergeant Shriver, would try to get the attention of the nonstop campaigning JFK and reached at a hotel near O'Hare Airport in Chicago. Kennedy responded immediately. He called Coretta Scott King from the hotel. His brother Bobby Kennedy called the judge the next morning in Georgia and demanded King's release. And he was released on October 27th on bail. The story got little coverage, but word leaked out in the African-American community, and one voice reacted loudly and clearly, Baptist minister Martin Luther King Sr., who had already endorsed Richard Nixon weeks before. He was a man who was openly suspicious of Catholics, but he went public. This man, Kennedy, King Sr. said, was willing to wipe the tears from my daughter-in-law's eyes. Well, I've got a suitcase full of votes, and I'm going to take them to Mr. Kennedy and dump them in his lap. Dozens of black leaders across the country, many formerly sharing a suspicion of Catholics, followed suit. 250,000 blacks voted for Kennedy in Michigan, the same in Illinois, a state Kennedy carried by only 9,000 votes. The decision, a single phone call, changed history. The memo sent to Vice President Nixon about the King case was never acted upon. It was lost. The moment passed, like the torch, to the Democrats in 1960. We are thrilled to have the central character in that drama with us. Harris Wofford joins us from Washington. Senator, thanks for being with us.
Delighted to be with you.
That is an amazing story. I get choked up even thinking about it.
The central character was candidate and Senator John Kennedy on the one hand and Coretta King on the other. And you told the story beautifully about Daddy King. He had been on a full-page ad a big ad in an Atlanta paper with a lot of Baptist ministers warning against a Catholic being elected to the presidency and supporting Nixon until Kennedy called his daughter-in-law.
And did you have any idea that your impulse to urge the candidate to make that call would be so historic?
Oh, we knew it was a very controversial idea because Kennedy wanted to do something. He had, in fact, agreed with the governor of Georgia that if he didn't issue any public statement that he had ready to issue and checked it with the governor of Georgia, the governor would get King out in due course. And so he was bound not to issue just a broadside statement supporting King. He wanted to get King out for the sake of American justice and also in the campaign. They obviously wanted this embarrassment because it's Southern Democrats, you have to remember, in those days that were the biggest obstacle to civil rights in this country. Until Roosevelt, the great majority of blacks voted for Republicans because of Abraham Lincoln saving the Union and ending slavery.
Sure.
Roosevelt switched, began to get a majority because the majority were poor and he was supporting the poor. But still, it was a very divided Negro vote, as it was called then.
And the evangelicals were very anti-Catholic. We forget that back in 1960.
Well, and that it was so difficult because the white majority in the South was supporting segregation, and supporting King was risking Kennedy's victory in any number of Southern states. Hmm. So I had no idea that Kennedy would necessarily do it, but we were blocked as to what could be done. And I said to a great black friend who was my colleague in the civil rights section we were running, if Kennedy could just call and convey his sympathy directly to Coretta, just personally, that's not issuing a public statement. And my friend said, that's it. We've got to get that idea to the senator. And I tried to get through. I had gone out on a limb on some civil rights things a little earlier in the campaign, and they were very busy on the road in the Middle West, and they didn't answer my phone. So I called Sergeant Shriver, later the founder of the Peace Corps, and he said, that's a wonderful idea. And wow. He had founded the Catholic Interracial Council in Chicago, sure. And he loved the idea. He was viewed as the civil rights lover in the family, and he said, "I'll get just if I don't get arrested speeding out to O'Hare Airport, we're going to get that idea to him." And when he got there, he saw Salinger and Sorensen and the staff in the suite, and he said, "It'll never happen if I wait while they're all there. It'll be a committee." He waited until the last one, Salinger, I think, or went into the John. And they were alone, and he put the idea to Kennedy. He said, Kennedy thought, smiled, and said, do you have her number? And called her.
Wow.
And she called me the next hour or two later and said, you probably put him up to it, but it was so wonderful. And well, Daddy King, of course, heard about it, and he went public.
The rest is history. The rest is history. Well, it's a great story in the retelling, and so important to remind ourselves of how racial politics has changed so much between then and now, 2008. And you are working with the Barack Obama campaign. We have to go, but former Senator Harris Wofford, thank you so much for joining us.
Remember one thing, 100,000 votes have made the difference.
That's right. That's right. Harris Wofford joined us from Washington, remembering the 1960 campaign and a test of leadership that's worth remembering.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry, live from Boston at our partner WGBH, a radio station in Boston. And the American League Championship Series is still on, folks. That's the big story here in Boston. The Red Sox came back from the brink of defeat to beat the Tampa Bay Rays 8-7. We're joined now by Frank Shore, a professor at Boston University, a longtime sports producer for Channel 7. Frank, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, John. Good morning.
So that was pretty darn dramatic. And do all baseball commentators in Boston have to be professors?
No, but it helps, you know. It's a it's kind of the progression in things that happen in Boston, you know. Listen, I want you to know that it's absolutely prophetic that I'm in a show called The Takeaway, because that's exactly what the Red Sox did last night. You know, it was 7-0, and then all of a sudden, the people in Boston are finding ways to get their way to Florida this morning.
I mean, it's unbelievable. My friend Kevin over at MIT took me aside yesterday afternoon and said, you know, John, we're going to win it. We're going to win it. I'm telling you, we're going to win it. And I did not believe until that 7th inning, and then the tears were streaming down my face. And I got to hug Kevin. I got to hug Kevin today.
Well,
did you believe?
Just the fact that the Sitka sign, you know, caught on fire the day before wasn't a good omen for that game last night.
Yeah, and it looked like there was going to be rain. I mean, there are all kinds of issues going on. Now, this has suddenly come down to a battle between experience and youth. What do you think is going to win out?
Well, it's the thing about coming back the way they did, it was really the first time in this long season, it was the first time where Red Sox fans could say, hey, I remember what it's been like to be down in a game and then come back with late inning
heroics. And all of a sudden, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, now, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays, they got to, you know, you got me saying it. The Rays are feeling like, well, we still got two games at home, and we still have the lead in this series here. But, you know, there's a little doubt that's starting to creep into their minds, and it's not like the Red Sox haven't done this before.
Right, yeah, talk to the Yankees about the comeback stuff. So Dice K really came through last night. Beckett's got to deliver a real game, though, for this to work out.
Dice K is kind of like that. He's that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of pitcher, and he gave up three home runs, and really there was no air in the ballpark at all last night, and the bullpen did a really nice job late in the game, and of course, David Ortiz hit his first home run in like 60 games, yeah. And it was just one of those times when all of a sudden Red Sox fans could say, hey, I remember what this is like to be down in a game. We can do this. We've done it before. We've done it against the Yankees. We've done it against the Indians. We've done it against the Angels. We can do this. You know, we're still in this. If Josh Beckett has got, if Josh Beckett has got the kind of stuff that he's had last year, he's had a very up and down season this year.
And some people think he's hurting.
Well, absolutely. I'm hearing that injury is a lot more severe than they're letting on.
And well, we will find out.
We're not going to find out anything now.
Well, Game 6 is down in Florida, and the drama will be set up again in this next game. Let's go out on the last play. Frank Shore, professor at Boston University, sports producer for Channel 7, thanks for being with us. Here's the final play last night.
3-1. Swing, line drive, right field. We're going to Tampa.
Red Sox win.
Go, Red Sox.
8-7.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 17th. I'm OK's here with the headlines of the hour.
Thanks very much, Adora. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. President Bush spoke this morning from the Chamber of Commerce in a bid to ease the minds of investors about the government's approach to dealing with the economic crisis. The president did not offer any new proposals and spoke before the markets had opened. And the markets opened down this morning. The Dow lost over 200 points in the first 10 minutes of trading. The Commerce Department reports that housing construction is at a 17-year low. Voting will start in just a little while in the United Nations Security Council, and Iran is competing for a seat even though the UN has sanctions against it. And a bomb blast near a mosque in Baghdad killed three people earlier today, and the people were leaving early morning prayers. It's the most recent in a series of killings blamed on al-Qaeda in Iraq. And finally, some good news. The Red Sox pulled off the biggest postseason comeback since 1929. They were down against the Rays 7-0 in the seventh inning, but battled back with the help from big hitters David Ortiz and J.D. Drew, and headed off to Tampa, who they still trail 2-3. And that's a look at your big news stories from this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi.
Thank you, Femi. J.D. Drew won that game, in fact. Well, this summer when oil prices reached record highs, energy was the very big campaign talking point.
Gas prices, $4, $5, no end in sight. Because some in Washington are still saying no to drilling in America. No to independence from foreign oil. Who can you thank for rising prices at the pump?
That's a John McCain ad on the issue, and here's one from Barack Obama.
On gas prices, John McCain's part of the problem. McCain and Bush support a drilling plan that won't produce a drop of oil for 7 years. McCain will give more tax breaks to big oil. He's voted with Bush 95% of the time.
well, who is the problem with energy policy in America? That was then. This is now. Wall Street has imploded. Energy and climate change have been eclipsed by the economic crisis, at least in the political discourse. But the world's looming environmental disaster and our dependence on fuel is only worsening, regardless of the price. And voters need to know how the candidates plan to reverse this global calamity. For a look at how McCain and Obama plan to tackle these issues, we turn now to Martin Smith, who's here in the studios of WGBH with me. In the upcoming Frontline documentary, Heat, Smith investigates how big business and government are responding to global warming. Martin, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
You know, this is a big topic, but Frontline loves to tackle the big topic. I'm wondering if it's possible to compare Barack Obama and John McCain on this issue in a really definitive way.
Sure. I think this is an interesting time. We've got two candidates who both say they want to address climate change. And as you mentioned, you know, now we've got the challenge of a global credit crunch, and going forward it's going to be very hard for them to take this up. But they both say they're going to do it. McCain has a long track record on this. Obama's come to this more recently, but I think he gets it too. So we're going to know in another 6 months, mm-hmm. how serious they really are.
You know, it's the progress that we've experienced in the last 8 years is that climate change, which wasn't even really in the political discourse at all, thanks to Al Gore and some others and to the crisis worsening, it now is in the political discourse. But the question of what you actually do about it, mobilizing the resources, and no single nation can really do it, that's really the challenge going forward. And, I'm wondering what definitive steps even a single country can take that's going to be impressive here.
It is going to take an enormous amount of political will. And while the discourse has changed over the last 8 years, action from the White House has not been there. And so any legislation that would come before on the Hill was not going to get signed by the president. And so we really haven't seen any progress in the federal government. What we've seen is that some states, California and some others, take this on. Kansas is confronted the construction of new coal plants, as a lot of other states have. So we've seen a lot of sort of action out there. And some businesses see opportunities here, and they haven't really maybe switched their views on climate change, but some see opportunities and have gone forward and made investments. But what it's really going to take is real political will from the White House. And that we haven't seen.
John McCain has talked about embracing nuclear energy in a fundamentally new and more aggressive way as a way of dealing with fossil fuel. I mean, the chemistry works out. I'm wondering if the politics and the economics works out.
It's very expensive. If we had built out a nuclear plant some years ago, cement and steel, all those commodities would have been much cheaper. Ever since Three Mile Island, and that was really even before that, banks were getting skittish about investing in nuclear because of waste and safety issues. But now McCain says he wants to build out 45 nuclear plants. Well, that's about how many nuclear plants are going to go offline in the next several years. Mm. So we're going to be sort of even. So we really have to build, if we want to increase the amount of electricity that we're getting from nuclear, which is right now about 20%, we've got to build like 100.
100.
And that's very, very expensive.
$2 billion a pop or something like that, right?
I think it's more than that.
Really?
I think these new coal plants that are going to promise clean coal, and that's another big part of this story, are up in that range. I think nuclear plants are costing even more than that.
You know, if you watch CNN and watch the campaign debates, you might think that the entire election was being brought to you by something called the Clean Coal Council. They're aggressive sponsors of political events on all of the cable networks. Describe the clean coal policy and which candidate has a better record on this.
You know, a few years ago, the coal lobby, that includes both the coal miners as well as the railroads who depend on hauling this stuff. About half of all the rail freight in the country is coal. And the utilities, of course, are the big part of that. They decided they had done some research and figured out that they needed to launch a PR campaign to make people aware that where electricity came from. Before that, they were happy to not have us know. But when they saw challenges coming, when the issue of climate change came on board, they thought, well, we better address this. So they launched this huge campaign, and they put a lot of ads on the debates through the primary season, and they're continuing this push. They spent over $40 million at the last pop. So they're very concerned about getting out there. They're pushing something called clean coal, which, in fact, doesn't exist. They're asking for – they want government money to invest in it. There are real questions. It's not so much the science as the feasibility of it. It's one thing to capture the carbon dioxide. It's another to find a place to put it. Not all parts of the country have what they saline aquifers is what they need, these places
right.
2 miles under the earth.
Places to dump
to
carbon
dump the
so
waste.
It doesn't go into the atmosphere.
And it's every pound of coal that you burn is about 4 pounds of CO2.
Wow.
And so it feels like Erie to get rid of all that CO2. It's a bigger waste problem in some people's view than nuclear.
What do you think is more important in Barack Obama's campaign strategy here? Is it specific initiatives that he's proposed on climate change, or is it his more broad notion that he's going to increase America's profile in the world, restore a sense of global cooperation, and maybe have the clout to bring a global initiative to the fore?
Well, look, I think on the issue of clout, McCain may have an advantage.
Really?
McCain has been at this for some time. He also, you know, this has been an issue, even though it's a scientific issue, climate change. I mean, scientists are telling us that this is an urgent problem. It's been on the Hill divided between Republicans and Democrats. And in a sense, McCain can bring more Republicans on board. And he has shown that he's interested in this in the past. I think that they both are sort of borrowing from the playbooks of conservatives versus liberals in terms of what they want to do with this. McCain wants to depend much more on a market solution, put a price on carbon, and let businesses figure out how to get around it, how to move towards cleaner energy sources. And I think Obama clearly wants to invest more, use more taxes and incentives and whatnot, and be more proactive.
Right. It's a great statement of the debate. Martin, we have to leave it there. Martin Smith, frontline correspondent, traveled the globe for the upcoming documentary Heat, a global investigation into what business and government are doing to combat climate change. There's this coming Tuesday on PBS. Adora?
Fascinating stuff. We're always on at The Takeaway, and here's something to take away today. What's the big problem facing America?
The other great scandal about this country is the complete absence of decent cups of tea.
That's our BBC friends with your takeaway, talking about what they learned on their 4,000-mile, 38-day journey on a bus traveling all over the U.S. And we're also conducting America's exit poll. When did you decide who to vote for? Who did you cast that ballot for? Why? What was the defining moment? Check out our political coverage at thetakeaway.org to hear other takeaway listeners as they talk about campaign politics with Femi Oke. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry with one more takeaway.
Push, blow, spit. Push, blow, spit. There you go.
You guys are shameless.
I had nothing to do with that. I just want to say that for the record.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.